Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Republicans control the White House and now have a firmer majority in Congress. What does this mean for the future of media policy and reform? Advocates for the public interest will keep close tabs on the lame duck session of Congress this month and are preparing to wage more major battles next year. Jeff Chester, the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, expects to see much more media consolidation, and there's much more than ownership of newspapers, radio, and television stations at stake.
The cable industry, which is already highly consolidated, wants even fewer ownership restrictions. That might mean that just two major companies, Comcast and Time Warner, in essence, control the industry. The future of the internet is at stake in upcoming FCC rulings and whether or not the internet will be required to treat all content on a non-discriminatory basis.
Susanna Montezemolo, a policy analyst with Consumers Union, says the near future may look pretty bleak, but it's important to think long term.
We may be playing more defense rather than offense. We're still working to get people to understand the importance of these issues to our democracy and to create new allies in the new members of Congress and senators who were elected and to really educate them.
The Republican majority at the Federal Communications Commission is also safe for another 4 years, although some of the faces at the FCC are likely to change. Chester says so long as grassroots resistance to media consolidation stays strong, there's still hope.
We have to restoke those flames of opposition. Concerned public has to be prepared to, fight and prevent further giveaways to the big media lobby. I believe that if we go on the offensive, if we're able to create a powerful coalition, we can make trouble at the very least.
And Montezemolo says when you boil it all down, issues of media control and diversity cut across partisan lines.
We don't consider media ownership a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. It's an issue that everyone should care about. And it's true that the Republican majority tends to be less favorable toward creating a truly, from our perspective, free and independent media. But it doesn't mean that things can't get done.
Montezemolo also believes now is an excellent time to explore other reform efforts, like putting economic pressure on media as consumers in hopes of forcing incremental change in the American media environment.
Looking back at the election, could it be possible that voters cast their ballots based on separate perceptions of reality? Surveys conducted by the Program on International Policy Attitudes, or PIPA, at the University of Maryland suggest this is the case. PIPA surveyed Bush and Kerry supporters twice in the month before November 2nd and found that a majority of Bush supporters still believed Iraq both had weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda, even though there's plenty of evidence debunking these myths. PIPA director Stephen Cull says it's quite common for American voters to disagree over campaign platforms.
What's unique in this situation is that there are real cleavages in terms of what is actually true. So you really have differences in their perceptions of reality here.
Just how do people manage to construct alternate realities? Cull believes it's a function of an emotional response to terrorism.
I think in the kind of environment that we have now, the post-9/11 environment, when there's a good deal of insecurity and anxiety about terrorist threats, there's a stronger tendency to orient to the leader. And in that context, there's a tendency to screen out information that calls into question whether the statements that he made were possibly not backed up by reality in the end. Because that creates a tension, that creates a kind of cognitive dissonance.
However, the mainstream media deserves some of the blame. PIPA did a similar survey last year and found that viewers of Fox News Channel were most likely to believe the false premises of the war, and the amount of Fox consumed was directly related to an untrue worldview.
The more they paid attention to the news on Iraq, the more likely they were to have these misperceptions.
This is not the only election issue mangled by the media. You may have heard that ballot initiatives passed in 11 states banning same-sex marriage. The reality is that only 3 of those referenda specifically mentioned same-sex marriage. The other 8 were much broader attacks on the rights of all couples to enter into civil unions or domestic partnerships.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okay, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host today, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest here in the studio with me is Tariq Ali, the internationally renowned political commentator, novelist, filmmaker, and playwright based in London. Ali has written more than a dozen books on world history and politics, including the bestseller, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity, as well as Bush and Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. He's written 5 novels, scripts for both stage and screen, and is an editor of New Left Review. And I think for many of our listeners of great interest, he's also the reason or the subject of the Rolling Stones song Street Fighting Man, one of the great songs from the late 1960s. Tariq Ali, welcome to Media Matters.
Very good to be with you, Bob.
And I should say to our listeners that we are taping this show approximately 10 days before Election Day in late October when Tariq Ali is here in town visiting during a week of events at the University of Illinois campus. So you're listening to this after the election. We have no idea yet what's going to happen. Although you can make a prediction if you'd like, Tariq, you know, that will be on the record.
Well, I think it's too close to call. But, I mean, those of us who watch America from the outside find it difficult to imagine a Bush re-election. It's so difficult for us, given the disasters that we've seen, the complete mess in Iraq, the loss of life in Iraq, both Iraqi and American, that for this president to be voted in again, given some of the policies he's been imposing on the country domestically, I think if that happens, one can only say the Democrats screwed it, basically, because this is a president who is eminently defeatable, and I hope he is. But there should be a great deal of soul-searching in the Democratic National Committee if this guy manages to win.
Well, you know, let's talk about Iraq, because no matter who won on Election Day, U.S. policy is probably not necessarily going to – there's no evidence from either campaign it will change dramatically the course it's currently on. And, we were told initially prior to the war that the war was based on weapons of mass destruction. It was based on connections of Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda with the 9/11 attacks, or at least there was an implied suggestion that that was the case. And those have both proven to be false and were known to be false long before the war by anyone who really studied the matter closely. That wasn't really subject to serious debate, in fact, in both cases. Today, though, what both candidates hold is that we're in Iraq now to build democracy, to put a stable democratic regime in place. And that, in our news media, is taken at face value as, in fact, exactly what is going on. What motivates the United States in Iraq is this tremendous, overwhelming desire to spread freedom, as President Bush has put it. You've written a lot about Iraq. You've studied the region a great deal. Is this a very accurate picture of what's taking place in Iraq today, or U.S. motivations in the region?
It's totally inaccurate. And what staggers me is how politicians who've lied blatantly to their people, both on the weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein's so-called links with al-Qaeda, can ever be believed again in anything they say, Bob. I mean, the weapons of mass destruction line was, of course, also pushed by Blair in Britain, where it was challenged quite seriously in the mainstream media. The Saddam Hussein al-Qaeda link, no British politician, I think the Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, mentioned it once, sheepishly and shamefacedly, and then never mentioned it again because they were embarrassed by that. Because anyone with any knowledge of the Arab world knows that Saddam Hussein, who was a secular, ruthless, but secular nationalist, hated al-Qaeda, and vice versa. Osama bin Laden once approached the Saudi king to let him raise an army to go and crush Saddam Hussein. So the notion that these people were linked is, of course, a joke. Al-Qaeda was never in Iraq during the Saddam Hussein period. It is now in Iraq as a result of the occupation, and that is something which people should think about quite seriously.
Before you go on, let's follow up on that point, because this has not been touched on in the U.S. presidential debates enough. to my knowledge, which is President Bush has claimed repeatedly in the debates and on the campaign trail that he, thanks to his stellar policies, he has wiped out three quarters of the al-Qaeda personnel in the world, which is an interesting claim. I don't know exactly what it's based upon. Yet at the same time, common sense and other intelligence reports from Israel and other countries suggest the exact opposite, that al-Qaeda now is going through an explosion in recruitment that is simply unprecedented. What's your sense of the state of the terrorist war?
Well, I mean, I always said after 9/11 that the key task of any sober U.S. administration was to discuss how to stop the flow of recruits to groups like al-Qaeda. And I argued that key to this was a serious settlement of the occupation of Palestine, by which I meant U.S. putting pressure on the Israelis, something they never do, and stopping the sanctions against Iraq to strengthen the people of that country. They've done the exact opposite. And the occupation of Iraq now, whether these groups actually join something called al-Qaeda or set up organizations like it is debatable, but there's no doubt there's been a massive increase in the number of young, embittered kids saying this is the only way.
And it's not just in Iraq. I mean, my sense is that across, but really across the world, but especially in the Islamic world, stretching all the way from Morocco to Pakistan or even Bangladesh or Indonesia, the antipathy towards the United States is at an all-time high.
It is. It's never been as high as this because, of course, it's always worth reminding listeners that during the Cold War, the Islamist groups were very staunch allies of the United States. They fought shoulder to shoulder, side by side, against the communist enemy, which was then supposed to be the evil empire.
The infidel.
Yeah. So this has now, of course, changed, and the open hostility to the United States in the Islamic world has never been as high as this. I certainly can't recall it during the Cold War period or during the Vietnam War. I mean, there was hostility, but it was divided. These countries were divided. This hostility is now at an all-time peak. And that is why no one believes the notion that what we are witnessing is gunboat democracy.
That's an interesting term. What are we witnessing then? What is your sense of what the Bush administration and the United States in general is trying to accomplish in Iraq?
I think there are basically two aims in Iraq. The principal aim was to remove a regime which they didn't like, though this was a regime which had collaborated with them very willingly for a long time. But they wanted to get rid of this regime. And I think there are two reasons for this. One was to, the principal reason was to grab an oil-rich country, not because the U.S. needed the oil or couldn't have obtained the oil through other means, but essentially to show the rest of the world, especially China, which is regarded as the future rival, look, we control the oil. It may not be our oil, but we control it. And this control of the oil is absolutely key to the thinking of certain U.S. theorists who say this is the way we will control our enemies and keep them at bay. And the second reason was, of course, to help the Israelis who wanted the Iraqi army wiped out because they saw it as a potential threat. And there's no doubt, as we know, that the Iraqis had been giving a lot of money and help to the Palestinians. So they wanted to stop that. But that, I think, is very subsidiary. The principal reason is to assert raw American power and to show the world what we're capable of doing. It's similar to the analogy I often make is the use of nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of the Second World War. It didn't play a major part in winning the war because the Japanese were already on their knees pleading, basically, for a peace treaty. And the justification which right-wing American historians provide now, which is that, oh, we did it to, we didn't to reduce the number of American lives lost, is not credible, because that war was very close to an end. The main reason for the use of those nuclear weapons was to show today's allies, but tomorrow's enemies, the Soviet Union and the communist bloc, we have these weapons and you don't. It was a display of imperial power. And I think the conquest of Iraq was a display of imperial power, both for the region, both for Iran, the oil-producing country, and for countries like China, which are heavily dependent on Middle Eastern oil.
What would the United States be doing differently if it actually was interested in promoting self-government in Iraq? What would its policies be different from what they are currently?
Well, the minute they occupied Baghdad, the principal leader and the most respected leader of the Shia segment of the country's population, which is about 60% of the country, Ayatollah Sistani, appealed publicly to the United States to permit free elections immediately to a constituent assembly, that constituent assembly would determine the future constitution of the country. He was told that this was impractical. He said, why is it impractical? We have every single citizen of Iraq is registered because everyone, because of the sanctions, had to have a ration card so the state could give them food and basic necessities so that the population survived. Mm-hmm. So every single citizen is registered. He said, we have an electoral college already there with these registrations. It wouldn't require too much to register those who aren't registered and have an immediate election. But this was not the interest of the United States at all. This is why this absurd notion that what's being done is promoting freedom of democracy is just nonsense. I mean, you know, there's some of us old enough now to recall that in the Cold War, during the Cold War period, when it was a defense of the free world was defended in Asia and Latin America by the most ruthless, vicious, brutal military dictators.
We're talking to Tariq Ali today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. This show was pre-recorded when Tariq Ali was visiting the United States during a whirlwind tour in late October, away from his home in London, England. And so this is a tape show. Please do not try to call in today. And as you've probably already gathered, we do not know the outcome yet. As intelligent as the two of us are to the U.S. presidential election, this was taped before the election. So sit back and enjoy a broader view of world politics than we might normally have had in a discussion right before the U.S. presidential election. You've written at length about the Islamic world. And, you know, I think, you know, you've been to the United States enough and you've know enough about the United States. What do Americans not understand through their news media, which is where they get their information, about countries like Afghanistan or Pakistan or the Islamic world in general? I mean, what are the main misconceptions that you think exist out there?
Well, there are two points to be made on this, Bob. The first thing we should say that there has been some advance, that at least most Americans now know that there are two countries called Afghanistan and Iraq. But it's an expensive way to teach the population geography. But nonetheless, they now know that there is a country called Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But I think it doesn't go too much beyond that. Mm-hmm. They think that what their government is doing is good. And they feel obliged to back it, largely because they are misinformed. I mean, you know, you remember before the Afghanistan war, the entire media joined in the political chorus that the Taliban regime was the worst regime the world had ever seen.
Oh, by far.
Yeah. And so we had to wipe this regime out and destroy al-Qaeda. Well, they couldn't destroy al-Qaeda. They did defeat the regime because the regime was largely the creation of the Pakistani military, which had now become a close ally. And the Pakistani generals told their supporters in Afghanistan, this is not the time to fight. Shave off your beards and come back home, which many of them did. Now, if you look at what's happening in Afghanistan...
Wait, Afghanistan today, we just had an election. It's free. It's a democracy. Women are voting. Come on.
Yeah. Well, if you talk to anyone in Afghanistan, they will tell you that this election is the biggest fraud ever, that everything was prearranged, that the warlords of the Northern Alliance who control large parts of the country determined who would vote and who wouldn't vote, that many women were not allowed out to vote by their extremely conservative husbands. This was essentially a charade designed for the American public, I would say, not even so much for Afghanistan. But the fact is, the real facts about Afghanistan are that the country is run by Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador there. He's known locally as the Viceroy of Afghanistan. And
now, explain the term Viceroy for our listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Viceroy was the British appointee who ran India during the British Empire for 150 years. And so Viceroy means proconsul, representing the metropolitan imperial country.
Yeah. I don't know, from Latin, assistant king or something? I'm not
sure.
Yeah,
yeah. And Khalilzad, it runs the country, and he is aware, because he's not dumb, of the isolation of the puppet regime in Kabul. And so he has reopened negotiations with who? The Taliban. So the Taliban, the most demonized people in the world, are now being discussed with to see if they will come into a pro-US coalition to give some political support to the puppet regime. And this is hardly ever reported in the US press.
No, in fact, the claims that are made by the administration or people in power are rarely, if ever, challenged, and largely because people opposing them in the Democratic Party don't challenge them. And so there's no groundswell of activity for journalists to play off of with official sources debating. This reminds me of the Wall Street Journal reporter who had the famous email that was circulated, the one who was on the ground in Baghdad a few weeks ago, or actually about a month before the show's airing or 6 weeks before its airing. And she or he, I can't even remember the gender of the writer, I think it was a woman, commented that if an election were held, Saddam Hussein would get more votes than George Bush to run the country.
Well, in Iraq, certainly he would. And unless, of course, you voted through certain machines.
you've been in America a while, so you're learning all about how these things work here. We're talking to Tariq Ali today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a tape show, as you can probably tell, taped in late October when Tariq Ali was visiting the United States on a tour. And we're airing it, of course, after the election, so we don't know the outcome of the presidential election yet. Tariq Ali, for those of you unfamiliar with him, is the author of a dozen books on world politics and history, including recently The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity, and Bush and Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. He's written 5 novels. He's an editor of New Left Review. And your books include a lot of material over the last 30 years on left politics, extensive work, in fact, on the state of the left, subject I'd like to talk about in today's show. But first, what I'd like to talk about is your homeland of England, the Britain, and Tony Blair, who has gotten a lot of attention in the United States for his pronounced support for the U.S. war in Iraq. And he's really stood out as one of the few, probably the only prominent leader who really isn't under the thumb of the U.S., basically, or U.S. interest directly, but has some autonomy, who has been a major supporter of the war. Why has Blair done this on one hand, and how has this played in Britain?
Well, we in Britain, we refer to him as the junior senator from England. I think the reason he's done it is basically because he believes in it. He's an extremely conservative politician. And initially, he was very close to Clinton. So when Bush got elected, some members of his party were hoping that he would move away. But after his first few meetings with Bush, he came back and told intimates, God, this guy's really cool. And I feel, much closer to him than I even did to Clinton. Of course, both of them share a very fervent belief in Christianity. And what is not often talked about in relation to Blair is that he is very deeply religious.
Now, I know in U.S. politics, if you have to talk about your relationship with God, and it's not uncommon for politicians to talk about discussions they've held with God or with Jesus. But I didn't think that was as common in Europe. I thought that was...
It's not common, which is why Blair doesn't talk about it. But the fact that he doesn't talk about it doesn't mean that he isn't religious. He is religious, and there is a sort of group of hardcore Christians around
him. Is he an Anglican? Or?
He is a high Anglican, but his wife is a Catholic. And according to sort of rumors, Blair is very influenced by Catholicism. And there's even talk that were he to resign or leave politics, he would probably convert to Catholicism. But having said this, Bob, the fact that the Pope came out strongly against the war, of course, had nil impact on Blair. So the direct representative of God, if you're a Catholic, the Pope, made no impact on Blair at all. He is essentially, in my opinion, a second-rate politician with a third-rate mind. He doesn't think too much for himself. And I know on U.S. television he can sometimes appear superior to his equivalents here, which isn't too difficult because he speaks with a fervor. But he's not a very bright politician, in my opinion. And the fact is he's totally divided Britain. His own party is extremely upset. There is no opposition on an official level in Britain, which is why Blair will probably survive the next elections, even though with a greatly reduced majority. But he's now been having a real go at the media in Britain.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about that because, you know, one of the general sort of rules that people follow in the United States when we talk about media is that public media, controlled, sponsored, nonprofit, non-commercial media like NPR, the station, the network we're on today, that receives public funding and doesn't have this advertising support, is going to be compromised by its relationship to the state and so incapable of being critical of the state, whereas commercial media, supported by advertisers owned by private interests, will have an economic separation from the state, so therefore be more willing to be critical of the state. In the United States, where we have a highly commercial media, our largest and most powerful commercial media, we now know and have conceded in many cases, were completely accomplices to the propaganda efforts of the Bush administration to push this war. And ironically, in Britain, the BBC, the public broadcaster, got into quite a row with Blair over the Iraq War.
It was a very serious row, as we now know. The director general of the BBC, in the run-up to the war and during the war, Greg Dyke, was a Blair crony. He was a crony appointment. He was very close to Blair. He'd given money to New Labour. The chairman of the BBC, Gavin Davis, was a very close friend of another senior cabinet minister, Gordon Brown, the Treasury Secretary in Britain. Gavin Davis's wife, Sue Nye, actually works for Gordon Brown. So these two key guys in the BBC were New Labour appointments. Mm-hmm. But once they started running the BBC, some of the ethos of that organisation, in the sense that you've got to be distant from the government which has appointed you, began to take over. And throughout the war and the run-up to it, the BBC were under very heavy pressure from the Prime Minister's office, and his press secretary, a sort of thuggish fellow called Alastair Campbell, was permanently on the phone. Why are you reporting this? Why did you ask this question? Why? What is your audience? You know, why are you having biased audiences present in talk shows? I mean, there's a very, very popular current affairs show on BBC television called Question Time, which I occasionally used to be invited on to. And one of the last ones I went on, just as the war began, I knew there was something odd in the audience. This wasn't a normal audience.
Mm-hmm.
And these were then pro-war people, including Iraqi, pro-war Iraqis, some of them working for the intelligence agencies, who had been put in there to challenge me, not at all representative of the country as a whole. This has now come out, incidentally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's during the big anti-war demonstration, for instance, when there were 1.5 million people on the streets, the BBC consistently reported 1 million people are marching in London against the war. The Prime Minister's secretary rang them up and said, why are you saying this? You know, why? How do you know it's 1 million? They asked the Director General, did you do a count yourself? He said, no. The demonstrators are claiming 2 million. 1 million is the police figure. And the police have made estimates of that march, and that is what we are broadcasting. But finally, Greg Dyke said to Blair, you have your job to do as Prime Minister, and I have my job to do as Director General of the BBC. So at the first possible moment, they got rid of him, they got rid of Gavin Davis, and created an atmosphere of sort of servile self-censorship at the BBC. If you look at BBC World, since the removal of Greg Dyke, it has gone right down. It's incredibly bland, barely different from CNN.
So it's coming more like the Voice of America in terms of...
It is. It hasn't totally become that, but there has been.
But that's the direction.
That's the direction. And, you know, you look at it like this, Bob. The United States appoints a total puppet, a former intelligence agent, Ayad Alawi, to run Iraq. You know, normally, every legend has a kernel of truth. But there is no truth whatsoever in the notion that this guy is representative of Iraq today. And yet, the way he's presented on the BBC, and it goes without saying the US media, is if this guy somehow represents Iraq, and all the United States and Britain are doing is responding to his calls for help. I mean, we've been here before, for God's sake. You know, let's cut all this nonsense out. And the BBC now reports this as if it were the truth, which is deeply shocking to many people in Britain who know what the truth is.
We're talking to Tariq Ali today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not call in. Just sit back and enjoy the show. In the last few years, for the first time in my lifetime, and I'm 51 years old now, the United States is oftentimes referred to, and not in a critical manner, by commentators and intellectuals as an empire. The idea that the U.S. is an empire is now increasingly accepted since 9/11 as a necessary evil, and maybe not even that evil once you realize it's necessary. And along with this, interestingly enough, and I want to put this in before you, is the notion, well, you know, we look back at empires, and the British Empire wasn't that bad either. These were actually some, you know, they brought civilization to the world, and they brought culture, and, you know, they did a good job of running the world, and maybe it's our turn to take over and help the masses of the world enjoy democracy and free markets. It's striking how this is now a legitimate term and how it's being sanitized. I know this is something you've written about as much as any author I know. What's your sense of all this?
Well, it's very interesting what's going on. I think, you know, those of us who know American history know that the United States has been an empire for a very long time. And it celebrated its, you know, the northern states celebrated the victory in the Civil War and united the country by occupying the Philippines. And it was a Confederate general who was appointed the first viceroy of the Philippines. So it's something which goes a long way back. But what is interesting is that the United States has always been in denial about it, saying we, after all, we got our own freedom by fighting against the British.
The Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah. And it's true that the United States is not and has not been like the colonial empires of the Europeans of the 19th and 20th centuries. It's a different empire. It essentially rules and has ruled through its own relays, indirect occupations via military dictators, oligarchies, etc. in Latin America. But often, even, you know, once the Monroe Doctrine was established in the 19th century, they've intervened without compunction to change governments in Central America and Latin America endlessly, and caused a great deal of violence and mayhem in those societies. So the new discussion now is that they should be like the British Empire. I go in for the long haul. But people forget what the British did, you know. I mean, all you have to do
is... Forget they never knew.
Yeah, either they never knew. Yeah. But, you know, all that someone needs to do is to go back and read the articles which were published in the New Republic in the 30s and 40s about the British Empire. Savage attacks for what the British were doing in their colonies and comparing, saying, what's the choice between the British Empire and Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
They're both roughly the same thing. So there was more knowledge when the empire actually existed. And, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, the Indian nationalist leader, was once asked by a visiting American journalist who said, what do you think of Western civilization? And Gandhi said, it would be a good idea.
That's one of the great lines of all time. You know, I think that when we think of empire and imperialism, it's presented in the sort of the global noblesse oblige of this great civilized power that's going to drag along the more barbaric elements of our species, which I think you've just pointed out is, you know, clearly the most self-serving nonsense of those in power. Doesn't stand up to a shred of analysis, and it would be laughable were it not so dangerous. At the same time, there's also a domestic side to empire, which I think that Americans are beginning to wake up to in terms of civil liberties and in terms of a general culture and whether you can have a humane society and be an empire. And what stimulates this question was with the Abu Ghraib torture pictures came out in the United States. And they really only had a very brief life considering what they really said about this war and about the U.S. role in the world. I mean, they had only because there were photos, too, there was a shelf life of about 72 hours in which they were discussed. And now they've been completely forgotten. They've gone down the memory hole. But there was a brief moment, and it was very interesting, on a U.S. show called 60 Minutes, which is on our CBS network, where they have this octogenarian named Andy Rooney who does a commentary. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yeah.
And he this is right the day it came out. He sort of was struck by it. And he made a comment that I think he had to be an octogenarian to make all this. He said when he looked at those pictures, he thought of probably what Rome was like in the 4th or 5th or 6th century. And that, he said to himself, this is what it looks like when an empire is in decline, when a civilization is collapsing.
It's interesting, that remark, actually. But when I saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib, like many other commentators, also from the Arab world, none of us were surprised, Bob. Mm-hmm. This is part and parcel of what occupations do. Every colonial occupation over the last 200 years has seen scenes like that. What is different is that they're being recorded and sent back as mementos, saying, hi, guys, here we are torturing a few Iraqis. That's what's different. The British did it in India, in Kenya. The French did it most brutally in Algeria. I mean, have people forgotten the tortures inflicted by the United States on the Vietnamese? Prisoners being hurled out of helicopters, ears of Vietnamese prisoners being cut off, and some officers wearing them as necklaces. We've seen all this brutality before. But for the new generation especially, I think, who believed some of this guff about going there for noble humanitarian aims, it must have been deeply shocking. For those of us old in the tooth, it wasn't shocking at all. It's normal. That is what colonial occupations lead to.
We're talking to Tariq Ali today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show done in late October, and Tariq Ali was visiting Urbana on a U.S. tour away from his home in London, England. So please don't try to call in. Sit back and enjoy the last 10 minutes or so of the program. You've been writing about the left for a long time. You are on the left. And I think you cut your teeth in the 1960s in the anti-war movement and the new left of the West. What is your sense of, the left's trajectory in the last 30 years? What role does it play today? What sort of prospects does the left have? I know these are huge questions, but they're questions that aren't very often talked about very much. And I think that they need to be in play if the left is to exist.
Well, I mean, the left has, of course, changed vastly. All the traditional parties of the left, the communist parties and even groups to the left of them, have virtually collapsed or gone under or, taken up new guises. And what you have instead is the big social movements which gather at Porto Alegre or at regional social forums of young people, but not simply young people, trying to find out which way to go. And, there is a slogan currently doing the rounds, which is a very sort of sweet slogan in a way, which is, we can change the world without taking state power. And it's sweet because it's well-meaning, but of course it's totally wrong. But it's almost that as if a new generation burnt by the 20th century are saying we can't look down that route. But you can't ignore history like that. You've got to learn the lessons of it. You mustn't repeat those mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the elementary things that were learnt at the time, A, that as long as you have capitalism, movements for social justice, whether they like it or not, have to devise an alternative to it. And devising an alternative to it means a form of socialism. I mean, you can't run away from that. And people say, oh, but it was tried and failed. Yes, that is true. But how many times has capitalism failed in its life? It's given us world wars, famines, depressions, mass unemployment. It's created the basis for fascism, which nearly destroyed Europe. No one says it shouldn't be given another chance. So I think precisely because of the forms now which global capital is taking, you will need new forms of democratic socialism to challenge it. I have absolutely no doubt about that. There's no other way. And there are examples. You know, some of the things happening in Latin America are very good.
Yeah, what sort of things do you see?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Venezuelan situation where Hugo Chavez, despite attempts by the United States to topple him, has survived, and not just survived, but he's survived with popular support. The entire media, Bob, this is a media show, in Venezuela is against him. The print media is against
him. No, it's like Sinclair Broadcasting times 10.
It is 10. As if the Venezuelan oligarchy was being served by Sinclair Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. A Cuban exile millionaire, Cisneros, owns the television channels. Despite all their attacks, and this is a heartening thing, Chavez has won because he's helped the poor. And the poor have elected him now 3 times to power. And I visit that country often. They've now set up. I told them, I said, you know, what we need in Latin America is a network like Al Jazeera, which gives an alternative view. And I even came up with a name for it. I said, let's call it Al Bolivar.
Mm-hmm.
And they are setting some such thing up now.
It'll be continental-wide?
They're trying to set up a continent-wide cable channel, but they need backing of some other states. I think the Argentinians have said they're going to come in on it, and the Brazilians are thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be tremendous, just to report on what's actually happening in the continent and not repeating the sort of wallpaper you see on CNN.
What other hopeful signs are there besides Venezuela, not just in Latin America, but anywhere in the world?
Well, I think you have, for instance, in the social movements which have developed in parts of Asia, signs that people want serious change. And the social movements tend to be parochial by their very nature, wherever they are. But what people are now moving towards in parts of the world is they're discovering that what the United States always wants is to do negotiate bilaterally. And they're saying we would be stronger if we negotiated as a region, or at least as 4 or 5 countries together,
mm-hmm.
which the United States tries to resist. So there are a lot of discussions going on around this, and I think over the next 20 to 30 years, you will begin to see developments in this direction.
Now, how about turning to Britain, Western Europe, the United States, the richest countries in the world? Do you see any prospects for anything close to a resurgent left along the lines of the new left, if not to mention the strong social democratic or labor movements of the earlier years taking place in the foreseeable future?
I think the time is right for the rise of a new left. I think we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of young people marching in the anti-war demonstrations. And I think they will have to find a way out of it. I mean, the choices they face are not establishment politics or the new left. The choice they face is establishment politics or dropping out altogether, you know, becoming so alienated from the system. And one of the dangers is the Americanization of European politics, which is proceeding apace. And one more thing, Bob, if I could say it. You look at the state of the United States itself. You know, there's large chunks of the country which lives in poverty. You have incarceration policies which are a disgrace. You have millions of people not insured for health care. And a serious government of whatever hue would put its own house in order before teaching the rest of the world what it should do and shouldn't do.
We're talking to Erika Lee today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a tape show, so please don't try to call in. We've only got a few minutes left on the show before we wrap up here. What media do you use to sort of stay on top of the world? What's your diet look like when you're trying to follow events in the world or in Britain, for that matter?
Well, in Britain, I read The Guardian and The Independent and The Financial Times to get three views.
And The Financial Times, of course, is available in the United States, and The Guardian and The Independent are both available
on the
online.
Web, yeah. These are three papers I read. Then to see what the Empire is thinking, I go to the web and read The New York Times, go to the op-ed pieces to read Krugman to see how angry he is. And then I go and read other sections of the newspaper. I watch very little television, Bob, I have to be honest. There's virtually nothing on it worth watching. And excuse me. And the BBC news bulletins have declined so much that it's become a bit of a farce.
What writers, you mentioned Krugman as a columnist in the U.S., but what writers, both popular or scholarly or academic, have you been reading recently that you sort of give you a lot of insight into the world?
Well, I always read Bob Fisk on The Independent. I think he's a very tough-minded, courageous reporter, and a reporter of the old school. Robert Fisk has never been on the left or associated with anything radical, just a very serious journalist.
And for our listeners who might not be familiar with Robert Fisk, I think many are. His name's come up on the show before. He is the lead Middle Eastern correspondent in Britain and maybe in the English-speaking world, for that matter.
I think he is, actually. There's no one quite like him. And I think Blair and company must be hoping that he drops dead soon. But, you know, we would be absolutely desolate if anything happened to Bob Fisk. He's one of the journalists we respect enormously.
And who else do you like to read?
Well, in terms of actual reporting from the field, there's no one else quite like Fisk.
Well, how about just book authors, too? I mean, just thinkers in general.
Well, you know, the thing is, one reads a lot of colleagues and friends. You know, Chomsky is someone I always read. And I notice that when people in the United States, formerly radical or marginally radical, are breaking away from the past, the first thing they do is denounce Noam Chomsky. I don't belong to the Chomsky left, they say, which, you know, Noam should be very flattered by, that he's become a pole of reference, that people moving to the right have to say, I'm not a part of the Chomsky left. I read John Pilger.
Another great journalist.
Yeah. And, I read Galeano, Eduardo Galeano, who keeps me
another
informed
great journalist.
Latin America, and I read his books. I also read a lot of stuff coming out of India and Pakistan for my own. There's no particular name there, but sometimes Achan Vinayak and Praful Bidwai from the Indian press do fantastically good reports. They're very, very courageous journalists. Then there's a young team of journalists around a website called VenezuelaAnalysis.com from all over the world working there who send in very, very good reports. So I keep myself informed. I mean, my one complaint is that I was hoping to finish off my Islamic quintet of novels. And first Osama bin Laden interrupted it with 9/11 and then George Bush with the occupation of Iraq. So my literary work has got disrupted.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Tariq Ali, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here. It's been wonderful having you here. Thank you for coming to the United States, and let's stay in touch in the future.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
On October 14th, the Federal Communications Commission adopted changes to its rules governing interference on the radio spectrum to allow for the expansion of a new broadband data delivery service. Broadband over power line, or BPL, utilizes the electrical grid to carry data at high speeds. It sounds like a great idea in theory, but BPL technology essentially turns power lines into antennas that can cause interference to users of the high-frequency radio spectrum, the area generally between the AM and FM radio bands. The American Radio Relay League, the nation's largest membership organization for amateur radio operators, bitterly opposed the change in interference standards as many of the frequencies they use stand to get swamped by BPL-related noise. ARRL spokesman Alan Pitts notes the FCC's recent ruling acknowledged the problem and modified its plan to prohibit BPL technologies that interfere with government, public safety, and aviation radio channels, but many other spectrum users stand to suffer.
Amateur radio, the CB, broadcast industry, to a large degree, any shortwave radio stations, and potentially channels 2 through 6 on television.
In the months before the FCC's ruling, ARRL members collected vivid evidence of broadband over power line interference. For example, a test conducted in Maryland this July provided some stark results. The first clip you'll hear is a popular amateur radio frequency recorded outside the BPL testing area. When the hams got closer to where data was flowing through power lines, the reception changed to this. A test of a different BPL technology in Minnesota this June produced a different sort of noise, but one no less disruptive. This is troublesome because amateur radio provides important lines of communication in disaster situations when telephones and broadcast media are disrupted. That's why entities like the Department of Homeland Security and Missouri State Patrol, among others, filed comments with the FCC opposing a boost for BPL. Alan Pitts says the technology might mean a new revenue stream for utility companies, but it's inferior to other broadband options.
Other technologies such as Wi-Fi and fiber optic are coming fast and are not spectrum polluting.
The FCC has committed to resolving interference complaints as they occur, but the agency's also admitted that it can't predict the extent of interference that could be expected. Even more curious is the fact that several technical studies were conducted on interference, but not all of them made it into the public record.
They were doing studies, but the FCC never released their studies. And the question is, why?
Ham radio operators nationwide plan to keep a close eye on the expansion of BPL technology and will test the FCC's commitment to resolve interference issues. As of now, BPL has only been deployed on a trial basis, but larger rollouts affecting entire cities and towns could happen as early as next year.
A major attack on press freedom affects dozens of countries with the flick of a switch. On October 7th, two servers that constitute a large part of the Indie Media Network were seized by British authorities, acting at the behest of the FBI, on a complaint that may have originated in Italy and or Switzerland. Sasha Meinrath, a volunteer with the IMC network, says the raid silenced several popular sites.
20 sites that move about 3.2 terabytes of information each month and get about 18 million web views per month.
This is not the first time that the collective network of independent media centers, which offers grassroots, non-corporate coverage of news events, has been intimidated by government authorities. However, Kurt Opsahl, a lawyer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, says just who was behind the raid and why remains a mystery.
Nobody has seen any documentation in this case. The FBI, through a spokesperson, has said a little bit, but we have had no chance to view the order sealing it, the subpoena itself.
Meinrath notes that while solid information is sketchy, there's a fair chance that a law was broken, and not by any IMC.
This sort of action of taking down servers to get specific information has been found unconstitutional before. A court case about 10 years ago over this very issue.
The servers have since been returned and are being put back online, but it's unclear whether they were compromised in any way or how much news content may have been lost.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high around 50 degrees and east winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 30s and southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy, the high in the middle 50s with south winds around 5 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.